From the village at Grand Traverse Commons, welcome to the Traverse City National Writers Series. More than 2,000 people are gathered on the front lawn of Building 50 on a beautiful summer evening for great food and conversation. This evening's guest is Food Network star and award-winning chef Mario Batali. Mr. Batali is author of many cookbooks, including Simple Italian Food, Mario Batali Holiday Food, and Molto Italiano. Founded in 2009 by New York Times best-selling author Doug Stanton, the National Writers Series is dedicated to creating great conversations with today's best-selling authors, journalists, and premier storytellers. The moderator of tonight's program, Paul Sagana, is co-owner of Zingerman's Deli in Ann Arbor. Paul Sagana and Mario Batali are on stage, and Paul is about to begin his opening remarks.
I'm going to make a confession first. I'd like to reveal something before you discover it on your own, as I'm really, really nervous, and I don't really know what I'm doing up here. And this isn't something I often do. So you'll figure that out on your own. So I'm going to ask you to bear with me. My partners told me to write things down because they knew I would screw everything up, so I did. And because when I got a call from Megan Raphael, and she asked me if I would, come up here and interview. No, she asked me if I would interview Mario. And I thought she meant that it would be over the phone on a radio station, and I said, sure. And then I went to the website, and I saw that, 2,000 of you were going to be out here, and I got pretty nervous. But I remembered that, I had just recently had my 40th high school reunion, and it was great, and I went into the hall where we were having it, and as soon as I walked in, somebody quickly walked up to me and reminded me that when I was a senior in high school, I was voted least likely to have a positive impact on society. And so I thought, hey, I'm 58 years old. It's not too late to start to turn things around. The National Writers Series is a great organization with a great mission, and so I thought I could start my road back to salvation. So that's why I'm here. So thanks.
Can I interrupt for one second? If that's the introduction, can someone bring me a drink, please? Any drink. I mean, one of those blueberry things would be fine.
So, Mario.
Yes, Paul.
Everybody can hear? Okay. No? So, I got to tell you, I've got family in Seattle. I go there quite frequently, and I've been to your father's store, and it's this little sandwich shop, and it's just marvelous, and it's tiny, and the line's out the door, and you get in there, and the people are warm and welcoming, and you sit down next to strangers, you end up leaving having made new friends, and it's really memorable. And I was wondering, have you ever considered following in your father's footsteps into the food business? And
you mean opening a little not so profitable restaurant?
No, I know. I'm just kidding with you. You know, seriously.
Well, hold on. Let me lead into that though, because my father worked. I grew up in the family of West Coast Italians and Canadian French Americans, and we grew up in what I would consider Sunset Magazine. And we always had food around us, and we were always involved in it, and it was never like we were doing sacred work or something special. We always cooked, we always had food, and that was just part of our gig. So I'm the only one outside of my dad and my sister who have followed in my meager footsteps, but I've basically found a way to continue.
Where's mine?
Wait, hey, what do you want? You get one and the other.
What's up with that?
I basically followed the tradition of my family, and then subsequently, after retiring from Boeing after 40 years, my father got into it because he saw how much fun I was having doing what we'd always done as a family anyway. So that's how it kind of led into that.
And, you know, his salamis are marvelous, and we serve them with honor in back in Ann Arbor at our roadhouse, and they're really, really great. So seriously, we know how that all turned out for you. And there's a lot of people here tonight, and they have their own questions, and they're going to get a chance to ask them of you. But I'm up here now. I got the microphone. Thank you. And so I'm going to take advantage. I'm going to take advantage of that and find out what I really want to know. The first thing is, for those of us who started our careers early in food, working for other people, we're always thinking in our minds when we're going to go off, open our own shop, be our own boss. When was that moment for you? When did it first hit you that you were going to leave your safe paycheck and you were going to, you know, roll the dice, bet the farm, go out on your own and see what happens? And can you talk about that, and also tell us how you came to that decision and tell us how it went early on?
Well, when I graduated college, I had decided that I didn't really like what I had studied. Not that it was a financial move anyway. I studied Spanish theater of the Golden Age. Not a lot of money in it, but a passion.
Growth industry.
Exactly, growth industry. And I also studied finance, and finance was an interesting field at that time. It was 1982 when I graduated. I believe about the time that heroin and cocaine addiction hit an all-time high on Wall Street. So it didn't really look like anything I was that interested in, but I was still fascinated with food, so after I graduated college, I went to Cordon Bleu and subsequently quit and went to work for a slave driver of certain renown named Marco Pierre White. It was when I saw what he did living outside the box and creating amazingly thoughtful and delicious food that was also in a crazy way presented in an artistic and yet odd angle that I realized that's what I really wanted to do as a business. At that point, I still had a lot to learn, so I worked in a bunch of kitchens as a slave, which is, by the way, if you're interested in learning how to do anything really good, you don't necessarily have to go to school. You have to go where they do it really good and work for them for free so they show you how to do it really good. Life lessons are often learned in school, but more often learned in life, is my advice. I worked there. I worked in California. I worked for a guy named Jeremiah Tower. I worked in some fancy restaurants and hotels. I went to Italy. I went to Turkey. When I came back and I came to New York, and I met my beautiful wife, Susie Kahn, who at that point was just a cheese salesperson of a certain quality. I realized that New York City was the place for me, and I had never really spent a lot of time there, but it was the most exciting, along with San Francisco, the most exciting place in the world for food that I'd ever been. And I realized that you could possibly open your own place. And I borrowed money from a group of friends, including my wife, and paid them back quickly. But we opened a restaurant called Poe in 1993 for $38,000, which was exactly how much we had in our pockets at that time, including the loans. And at that moment, when you really put everything you have into something, not only emotionally and financially, but just in a mystic way that you've really put it down and bet on it, that's when you realize you're either in or you're not going to be in. Now, I know a lot of people who've tried that and have walked away from something like that after a certain amount of disappointment and gone on to something else and been successful. But the trick is, if you're going to get into it, and what really worked for me was having a support group of chefs in New York City and their kind of passionate excitement about the food and the green market and the restaurant idea and the customer base, that was when I realized that I was really going to love this. Now, one of the beauties of New York City, which is a little different than Traverse City, is that in New York City, if you make decisions as a restaurateur and you want to make it the most artistic and personalized vision that you can, that often enough has its price when you're doing that kind of business in a market. In fact, that you may insult people or not give them exactly what they want. The beauty of New York City, of course, is that even if 5 million people hate you, there are 7 million left. So the choice of the location is actually the single most crucial part. You have to find a place that even if you're not successful for everybody, you can still be successful enough for you to dig what you're doing and to continue to grow and develop.
All right. So,
sorry, it was a long answer.
No, that's good.
Thank you very much.
You know, when... Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. When my partner Ari and I first opened...
Let me just interrupt real quickly. I'm not sure if you're familiar with how significant this partnership of these two guys, Ari and Paul, is. Zingerman's is without a doubt, in the 21st century, one of the single most influential food places on the entire planet, not just in Michigan, not just in the Midwest, but something that is truly serious and a place that when we come out here from New York City, we plan our entire drive about how many meals we can squeeze in to the Zingerman's experience.
Thank you. Thank you.
They have revolutionized what service, what style, what deliciousness is, and most significantly, customer satisfaction. It's truly revolutionary. Sorry.
No, that's the end of our interview today.
Thank you very much. We'll see you
Thanks
at the bar later on.
We're open 7 days a week. So, Mario, when my partner Ari, who you know very well, when we first opened almost 29 years ago, we said that we're going to have one place, and that it's we're not going to be the biggest, we're going to be the best, But over time, we changed that vision, and we've opened several food-related businesses so that we could bring in employees that were working for us as managing partners. They wanted to, so we provided an opportunity for people to grow professionally, financially, retain good people. And our big challenge has been to maintain the culture, the quality level, the level of service. You've got restaurants not only in New York, in Las Vegas, in Los Angeles. What have you done? What's your secret for building the loyalty, maintaining the commitment of your staff as you expand those businesses? How do you do that? And how do you maintain that iconic customer experience that you talk so eloquently about? How do you do that?
I think the key is, we've never hired an executive chef or a general manager that didn't already work for us. The key is to have people that are steeped in your culture, in your understanding of guest satisfaction, in the rare and odd and yet crucial occasion of oddly every now and then saying no to somebody. We've never hired anybody above the level of a line cook, which is a high position in my opinion, but an entry-level position for a lot of people, and it's the way they get in. And once they've started there, they understand, first of all, the basic hard work of the trenches, but they also learn how, myself and my partner Joe Bastianich, how we want things, how much we're really proud not to necessarily be inventors, but we're more or less the translators or the influencers of the classic beauty of the Italian table. We say we've never invented anything. All we're doing is trying to bring our awe and our happiness about the Italian table to a large group of people. Now, the most crucial business decision in understanding that growth level, starting with one restaurant and going to two, at this point we have 15 restaurants, at this point we have 2,100 employees, 2,000 of which are geniuses, 100 of which are going to be geniuses. But the most crucial and seemingly difficult to understand thing for a lot of other people is, as an owner, you don't need to make all the money. And when you understand that and are willing to share and give incentive and allow the people to be a part of the upside of their proper and well-made decisions that are still within the ideology of what we think is the most important thing, which is the honor of the Italian tradition, then those people start to feel that not only are they working for some really cool guys and making some nice coin this week, but they also see, hey, this is a long-term project, very much like your guys. And we share a similar philosophy in that we're not here to show off. We're here to show. And we want everyone in our team to love it as much as we do, so we give them the footing to bring themselves up and to participate in not only the success of the operation, but the financial success of the operation. And that's why people are staying with us.
All right. I like when you say you're not, trying to come out discover new things. We talk about We're not going out there to discover the next great thing. We're trying to rediscover things that have been forgotten,
exactly,
but have existed for a long time. We kind of feel if people were making them and eating them and selling them for a few hundred years,
there might be something to it.
Exactly. So as you've grown now, success is defined in many, many ways in business. How do you define success? And what have you learned from your past endeavors that are going to affect what you do going forward?
I would say there are many levels, as you just said. There's a bottom line, there's a gross profit, there's a gross sales, there's a number of employees, there's a guest satisfaction survey, there's 1,000 ways to measure it. The way I try to measure my success is as many things as I have going on and as how much business as I have is how much time I get to spend in Northern Michigan every summer.
Yeah!
And I must say that as hard as I work, this summer looks like I may get to 61 days. Which for me means I'm spending 61 days with my family and friends in a place that I truly love. I still love New York, and I go back there all the time. But when I'm in the summer, I'm looking at it as my kind of payoff. I really put an email, at, one of those automatic return messages, except mine says, I will never see your email. Please call me in September if you have any idea of anything you ever want to say. Pardon my French. And it's the ability to allow my guys and gals and my teams to run those operations during the time when I feel I really want to recharge the family battery and hang out in the right place, that's when I think that you're most successful. It's not necessarily that you measure your success by how good you are when you're there. It's how good you are when you're not there that often gives you that success. That's not necessarily true of a single unit operator, but in the position that I've somehow forced myself into, it seems to be a good measurement for me now.
From the Village at Grand Traverse Commons, you are listening to an evening with celebrated chef and writer Mario Batali on Interlochen Public Radio. Mario is talking with Paul Sagana, owner of Zingerman's Deli.
We hear about how you started and started in the food business. Let's focus on your writing a little bit. You said, I've read that you dabbled in fiction in college, and clearly you're very well read. You write every word in your cookbooks, and you've written quite a few, and you got more in the pipeline. And I got to tell you, I love reading them. For me, they're authentic. It's really like I'm in a classroom with a really cool teacher, and I'm learning something, and it's making me get excited and making me want to run out to the library and read more. So let's talk about your first book. When did you realize you were going to write a book? Did somebody come and say, hey, Mario, you got to write a book? Did you think I'm going to do it? Was it something you always wanted to do? How did it come about?
Well, I have always loved writing. When I first got my very first show on the Food Network, it was when the Food Network was in 14 million homes. It was filmed or taped, not even filmed. It was taped in a crappy two-bedroom apartment with a small studio in it on like 35th Street. And it was, at that point, still national. And it was really unsure whether the Food Network was going to be a big thing. But there were some publishers who kind of tried to figure it out. They'd seen the success of Emeril Lagasse's books, and they had kind of equated that with that. It wasn't necessarily all due to the Food Network. It was because Lagasse really was the first guy to put men in the kitchen in a successful way, and it was a very smart thing, and he did a really great job. They came to me and they said, listen, how'd you like to write a book? I thought it was really great. I'd made the same very often made freshman mistakes that confusing the idea that everyone really wanted to know a lot about me and my personal story. In fact, a really good book is not necessarily about you. It's seen through your prism. And it often will relate experiences that other people can relate to outside of your own experience that seem to make a little sense. Very much hitting the same kind of thing when someone like U2 plays a song and everyone recognizes it the third time through. It's because they've hit something that's a little deeper than just the straight story that they're talking about. And that's with all art. The way that great artists, and I'm not a great artist, but I understand what they're doing, is when you can hit the strings of people that they're not even sure they know why, but it hits them in a way that makes them relate to it and feel a part of it immediately. That's what really good art can do and can be about it. And writing is the same thing, as is music, as is painting, as is pantomime, as is comedy. All of these things can come together in that way. And I wrote this first book, and it was a little greedy and a little bit self-satisfying, but I really enjoyed the process because it was very different from my normal go in the morning at 7 o'clock, cook my ass off until midnight, and then go have a couple of drinks and go home. So it was a part of the day that was a new part of the day for me, that you could live outside of your traditional role. And that's what I really grew to enjoy and love about it, and which is why I kept writing books. The customer response to it was traditional. They liked the recipes. They didn't really care about the story, and that's a good thing. But at the end of the day, it's a great additional portion of your brain to develop. And I can tell everybody in this room that if you like to paint or write poetry or do dance or you know, ride motocross, whatever it is, when you find something that you can do outside of your normal daily work that gives you that kind of zenny escape from your reality experience while still participating in something, there is great pleasure and great satisfaction to be plumbed from that. And you have to think that way if you want to really continue to develop your normal craft. So that's why I do it.
Okay.
I'm a little soapboxy. I'm sorry. I'm going to get off the soapbox.
Well, I'll give you an opportunity. I'm interested, you know, talk a little bit about that process of writing. How, where, when do you find the time to do that in this crazy, hectic schedule of yours?
Well, will attest to it, I generally write most of my books on vacation. And I just happen to get up a little earlier than everybody and spend a little time writing, and I really enjoy it, but the key to any success is to developing some kind of an outline, some kind of format that piques your interest, and then writing it down, whatever it does, how it is, whatever it goes, and then editing it back and seeing if it sounds like what you really think. And that is the process that I've always enjoyed. And I don't purport to have an amazing or unique point of view, but I have a voice that people recognize, and it's the voice of someone who loves the Italian culture and Italian food, and who loves the idea of everything that I do, and particularly loves my family and hanging around with them. So when you can espouse that, and even in a short little introductory line to your recipe called a head note, if it comes across that it's you, then the people understand that and they want it. A lot of cooks and a lot of chefs who write cookbooks actually hire another writer to do it. And that's not a bad thing, it's a good thing to do. But you lose a little bit of that person that you're looking for. And I have never done that, so you get me whether you want it or not. And that's, I think, the idea of what a great voice or good voice or even my mediocre voice can be.
I think it's a great voice.
Well, thank you.
I think you guys think it's a great voice. So another voice that's out there, Jim Harrison.
Oh.
He's another.
Jim Harrison!
Another native son, Lee Lenaw. He's a good friend of yours. Drinking, eating buddy.
Writing, walking,
probably was your first choice for this interview. I talked to your wife. She told me I was down on the list of ways. I don't mind. I'm here.
You were number one.
I don't mind. I'm here. But and he's a great deli customer. So and he's been very kind to us in his reviews. I love him. Everybody has a Jim Harrison story or two. I'd like to know one of yours, and then on a more serious note, as a writer, what do you admire most about Jim's writings?
I'll start with what I admire most. I think he possesses one of the most unique, purely American, most learned, eloquent, and delicious voices of all time. Clearly, in my opinion, one of the great American writers, if not one of the great world writers. And when you sit with him, it's very much like you're reading the characters in his book. And when you're reading the characters in his book, it's very much like you're sitting with him. My children can do a much better interpretation of Jim because he leaves the odd message on our house. But it often goes something like, Mario, I was thinking this week about short ribs. I'm going to braise a few with 1,000 cloves of garlic and some beer, and I just wanted to know what you think about that. Call me back. That's Jim Harrison in a box.
You know, he is a character. And one time we were involved in a lawsuit, and never get involved in a lawsuit. And
And he was gonna be an expert witness for us, and he was gonna be deposed. And I called his publicist, and I said, we need him to come down on, this was probably on Thursday. I said, we need him to come down on Monday. I'm happy to go get him. She goes, you're not gonna get him. He was up late last night with his friends. They started talking about where the best chili in the country was. They got in a car and drove to Texas. I'm not gonna see him for a few weeks. We didn't get
how much more can you love a man like that than that?
We didn't get that deposition.
Right.
But we won the lawsuit.
Good. So everything worked out.
Everything
got his chili, and you won the lawsuit.
Yeah. So writing and cooking. Seems like you've been able to marry your two great loves together. Talk about the way they're different in demand, the different demands, and how are they similar? How are they dissimilar?
First of all, what are they drinking in that corner that they're having so much more fun than us? You know what that is? It's where the cooks are hanging out right now, my friends. If you can, hang out with cooks. Marrying the two, I mean, I think it's not necessarily about marrying the two, because you don't write when you cook and you don't cook when you write. What it is it's about being able to plumb something in you that you can write down that can clearly, without too much ambiguity, and yet a certain amount of mystery and ambiguity still involved in it, describe exactly what you want to happen. Whether it's in a cooking situation, or whether you're writing about cooking, or whether you're writing poetry, or whatever it is. If you can invoke in somebody the passion to get down there and find veal cheeks and braise them in the right way and take the 25 proper minutes to brown it just right, and then to take another 25 to 30 minutes to create the right texture and right viscosity of your braising liquid, and then you braise them for the right 2 hours and 20 minutes, and then you allow them to cool, and then you peel off the skin and you chop them, and then you make the pasta, then you put them inside the pasta, then you put the pasta aside, and then you make the butter sauce that goes with it, and then you wait for someone to come into your house who wants to eat it, and then you make it for them, and you grate the just exact right amount of Parmesan cheese over it. Just understanding all of the complex steps is one thing. Being able to describe it so that someone else can make it is another thing.
Who's hungry again after listening to that?
But that's what cooking's all about. The success of chefs is often reading cookbooks and never, ever looking at the recipe. You look at a dish, you see that you want to make it, you know in your heart that you can make it, and you kind of use the book kind of like a novel. You read it, you look at it, but you don't really look at it. One thing I can suggest to people that want to expand their palate and understand things just a little bit differently is every now and then, and I do this every now and then, is look at a cookbook written by someone who you really respect and put aside your own steps of ideology and follow it exactly as it's written. What you'll find, because I often add the same amount of salt that I do, or I squeeze lemon in at a certain amount of time, or I braise things for a certain amount of time, or I use this kind of tomato, or I use this kind of celery, or I cook it for this, just by my own thought. If you follow someone else's recipe that's a little bit different than yours, you'll find that driving off that road gives you an incredible insight, not only into their cooking, but into the way that you cook. And that is a really fascinating thing to discover. When you taste something, you're like, wow, that is different than the way when I normally make my meatballs, or when I braise my veal cheeks, or when I make my linguine with clams. And it's a really interesting thing also when you're reading someone's literature. You follow and understand what they're going to, and you try to see what they're going at in a way, the way it doesn't relate to you. And that's when you start to find things that become more than the sum of their parts.
All right. So, yeah, give it to them.
To Bridget.
Mario, you spoke about the Food Network earlier, and in interviews before and in writing, you know, you've credited the Food Network with reshaping America's eating habits. You said, and I quote, "This country was headed down a corporate manipulated path that has destroyed food, and I think the Food Network, along with Alice Waters and the slow food movement, has been helping us reclaim our traditions." That's a surprising statement and accurate in many ways. My only issue with it is that you took yourself out of the equation. I think you single-handedly elevated the level of discussion and detail on food shows. And to me, it was shocking at the time, sitting there watching the television. I remember thinking, this guy's a real chef. And you know, you showed the viewing public you could enthusiastically absorb a lot of pretty specific historical information and accurate culinary referencing, and not feel talked down to, as long as it was delivered in an entertaining fashion by a very large, enthusiastic man in clown shoes. You proved that food is interesting and rewarding, and by its nature, democratic, not just for the elites. So tell me, how has the rise of food entertainment in its current evolution impacted American eating habits, do you think? Do you want me to repeat that? Because it's kind of long.
A lot.
Okay.
I think what the Food Network's done has created a place where the discussion about food can happen on many, many levels. And there's 1,000 ways to look at it, from Sandra Lee coaxing you into staying out of the fast food restaurants and using pre-made whipped cream and frozen berries and already made pound cake to make something you call your own, to something as complicated as Rachel Ray cooking chicken breast with mushrooms. There's a lot of ways to skin the cat. And I think what the Food Network did when it went from the 12 million people that it had in the house when I started to the 150 million people whose homes it's in right now, it has changed its business model, but predominantly what it has done is brought a conversation to the table about everybody, to everyone's table, about what food is. Is it nourishment? Is it science? Is it pleasure? Is it sex? Is it fuel? There's 1,000 ways that a lot of people have looked at it, but they never really examined it very carefully. And what the rise in popularity of food and chefs and food writers and slow food movements is only going to be good for America as far as it allows us and forces us to think about what we're eating, to evaluate where it comes from, and to decide exactly what it is that we want to do with this food and what we're hoping to get out of it. And as long as it becomes an intellectual exercise as well as a pleasurable exercise, that's where the two come together, and that's where the Food Network's put it together to make it happen. They've given it a forum from which people can take whatever they want. It doesn't have to be a five-hour dish of my design or a 30-second dish of Sandra Lee's design. It could be a crossover. And finding that you want to be involved in it heavily one day and just a little bit on another day is one of the great successes of understanding what really American cooking is all about. And that's the key to what they've done. And I've been happy to participate in it on my level. My level is I'm celebrating Italian tradition. The beauty of my show is I didn't have to invent any dishes. I took them from all the regions. Americans thought pasta and lasagna and pizza and spaghetti with meatballs was Italian food. I think now Americans may know there's a few more regions, there's 21, and that each one of them has its own separate rich cultural heritage, and that it's a fascinating place to do and understand and be a part of. And if I've brought them to that, then I've done my job.
You certainly have done that. You certainly have done that. You've done that, and you're also a traditionalist who breaks the rules from within the rules. I would equate this to a musician or a poet, you know, who knows and masters the traditional forms and then knowingly tweaks them with a nod to the original form. You've said it's about, and I quote again, getting to the specifics of regionality, that to eat the boiled head of a pig sliced like a salami is very strange to many people, but it's very traditional. So, genie in a bottle granted you one wish, allowing you to change one element of the American food system. What would it be?
Wow. I would say that outside of a few staples, if we could force Americans 3 days a week to eat food from within 100 miles of their house, I would be successful. Not every day, because every day is too far. But for people to understand what seasonality is and to celebrate it and be excited about it, and to understand the plight and the success of the local farmers and the meat raisers and the winemakers and the butter guys, that would be something that might change the way we really think about our food, but in a positive way, in a way that's leading us toward the Italian ideal. Keep in mind, in America you can get raspberries 365 days a year at your grocery store. In Milan, you can get raspberry 365 days a year. In a little town between Bologna and Florence, raspberries are in raspberry season. If a raspberry were to show up the week before Christmas, it would be a citywide scandal. Not only would they be upset about it, they would be angry about it. And that attachment to their own dirt, to their own land, to their own air, to their own market, is something that if we can have that in America, we'll be better.
All right. I'm going to change
good.
Up a
You're
little
You're doing
here.
Good, man. You're
Change
rocking.
Up a little here, right. Okay? I've heard about people wanting to go home. You know, they're far away from home. They're working. They're doing something important. But they always want to go home for Christmas. They want to go home for Thanksgiving. I have never, ever heard of anybody needing to get on a plane and fly across the ocean to go home for Halloween.
But well, that's you should go to San Francisco.
But that's exactly what you did when you were hopping around Spain with Gwyneth Paltrow, eating fabulous food, and I don't imagine that you were roughing it that much. What's up with that? I mean, is it the candy? Is it Halloween's got that orange theme going? You know, I don't know. Do you carve pumpkin heads in the shape of pigs? Do you what exactly is it with Halloween?
I got
anyway?
Your question. I got your question.
I'm dying to know.
All right. Those two guys right there, Benno and Leo Battali, have considered Halloween the single most important holiday of the year. More than Christmas, more than Rosh Hashanah, more than all of the other religious and other holidays together. So the idea of missing a Halloween or the day before, I mean, when Susie rocks out the Halloween house, I challenge you to come down the hall of our apartment building and not be petrified when my wife sits there with a witch mask on and rocks and doesn't say a word. It will challenge the hardest soul. But that said, Halloween was a big family holiday for us, much bigger than, say, Valentine's Day. So it was the middle of a shoot, and they were actually going to Granada, which is a place I really wanted to be on that particular shoot, but I didn't want to be in Granada any more than I wanted to be with my kids on Halloween in New York City.
All right.
Who told you that?
Do you guys pass out candy?
We pass out candy.
What do you pass out?
Well, if I had my druthers, it would be bocce, but we kind of go down the white trash road, too. I don't know, what did we give? Leo Bennett, what did we give for Halloween last year? Twizzlers. Twizzlers.
I love Twizzlers.
I gotta say, though, Twizzlers, yeah, they're great, but whatever. Were you ever excited about getting a Twizzler in your bag? Twizzlers almost merited the flying, burning zucchini into the door when I was growing up.
Okay, so you talk about your sons.
And my wife.
And your wife. So I have two sons, too, Zach and Ben. You know, you have Benno and Leo.
Yes.
Mine are 27 and 21. Yours, 14?
Almost 14.
14 and 11.
And a tall 12.
And a tall 12. Mine are young adults, and they've grown up with an appreciation of great food. They have wonderful palates, and they're both pretty creative cooks. But they're really out there doing their own thing, going in distinctively different directions than I did. They're a much rougher direction. They're both, you know, doing the risky work as artists. Father to father, what do you hope for your sons?
I hope that they will find the path to satisfaction and happiness, no matter whether it is being the best butcher in the world, or the best trumpet player, or the best dancer, or the best tent builder, or the best chair builder, whatever. As long as they find something that they love to do, The beauty of work is if you really love what you do for work, you're never at work. I'm the kind of guy that never looks at my watch and says, 2 hours, I gotta go home. I'm the kind of guy that looks at my watch and says, I should have gone home 2 hours ago. And that's when you love your work and really enjoy it and are enthused by it, you never spend a day at work. I could work every day and I could not work at all. And I would feel exactly the same.
All right.
From the Village at Grand Traverse Commons, you are listening to an evening with celebrated chef and writer Mario Batali on Interlochen Public Radio.
I don't know if a lot of people know this about you because you don't make a really big deal about it, but you have a very well-documented commitment to parlaying your 800-pound gorilla status into something very, very positive. You donate hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in cash, and your personal appearances at cooking events raise millions of dollars. And tonight's just one example of that. And I know that you focused your giving efforts on the well-being of children, especially hunger relief, literacy, childhood disease prevention, and cures. You've been quoted as saying, on a basic level, everyone should be able to read, everyone should be able to go to the doctor, and everyone should be able to have a dinner every day. Hot dinner every day. So the conservative economist Milton Friedman is famously quoted for having saying, the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits. That can be interpreted as meaning the business of, and it often has been, the business of business is business, period, end of story. What do you believe the social responsibility to society is of a business and to the community from which it draws its revenues?
Good question.
Thank
I
you.
Do not see business as having any responsibility other than to business itself. I agree with Milton Friedman that business itself, as an abstract idea, should be taking care of business. Fortunately, business is always run by individuals. And the individual has a responsibility not only to take care of the individual's family, but all the other individuals around it. And in fact, and this brings us to a much larger discussion about what government might be or might not be. I wish Ted Nugent was here, because I'd love to go Indian wrestling with him right now. If we've decided as a group that we will commonly share the benefit of our protection from invasion, we should also decide that we will protect each other, and that what's really significant about getting together and sharing all of that benefit is sharing it with everybody. So at the end of the day, if we're going to have a government, we should have a social health program. Everybody should go to the doctor, and they should go at almost no cost. And if we're going to have a government, then we should also have a way that everyone gets fed. Believe me, running out of food is not an issue in America. But almost 10% of Americans have food security issues. And it's not because we're short. It's because we have a poorly designed distribution system. And if we could get all of that food just to us, we'd have a lot extra that we could share with other people outside of our borders that actually need it. And what we have is a really big system that's being pulled by two equally powerful and equally relevant groups. We have our Republicans and we have our Democrats. And unfortunately, we're two countries right now. And there's really no answer unless someone actually could gain a little bit of plurality. So our real issue is not deciding how cool we can be on which side, whether we're pro-business or pro-socialism or pro-Obama or pro-Bush or pro-whoever. What we really have to do is figure out how we can work together in a two-group system to provide everybody with a little bit more of the benefits of our great society. And that's what it really comes down to. Sarah Palin is not going to die, and neither is Obama. So we got to deal with both of these guys, and we have to figure out a way that somehow compromise doesn't necessarily come at the cost of the regular lower middle classes, who are the ones who are bearing the brunt of our improbable discussion right now.
I want to get a little more personal with you.
All right.
I'm realizing, you know, I might be your doppelganger here.
All right.
We're both born on September 9th.
Well, you see, you got your information from Wikipedia. I was born on September 19th. But we're 10 days apart, baby.
We both have long, successful relationships with a business partner.
Mm-hmm.
We both have two sons. We're both married to really beautiful, intelligent women who are smaller than us and much better looking than us.
And challenging.
So, many years ago, you had a brain aneurysm. You had a brush with death. About a year ago, I had a heart attack. I had a brush with death. Your wife described it as your Marilyn Monroe moment, whatever that means.
I don't know what that means.
My Marilyn Monroe moment?
I got to tell you, for me, it got my attention in a very, very dramatic way, and like nothing else could have, and it made me ask a lot of myself about if I was doing what I really liked to do, and it made me think about things in a much different way. I'm really curious if anything changed for you after that event.
I have bad news. I'm much more shallow than you, Paul. I didn't think it was anything more than a little blip in the road. I'm like, all right, whatever. I almost died, but, you know, I'm alive. So it seems to... I've always been the guy who blessed and counted my blessings and felt incredibly lucky. So this was just another of the series of lucky events that happened to me. That said, in retrospect, learning about it, I realized that 5 out of 10 people that have an aneurysm die immediately. Of the remaining 5, 4 out of those 5 have some kind of lifelong disability or some kind of stroke result. That's a part of it.
What was your disability?
I just got stupider and happier. Oh. So whether it was a flaw in the system or I slipped by, I mean, I look at it and I help the aneurysm awareness group because basically if an aneurysm happens to you and you don't take care of it relatively quickly because you just think it's a headache, that's when you have problems. If you have it and you can quickly take care of it and have it assessed and have it repaired, which is they just go in and put a little clamp on it. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically if you take care of it immediately or you recognize the signs, it's not necessarily a life-ending situation. But if you don't, it can be.
Okay. Okay, so...
Live every day like you're not going to live tomorrow. That's my advice to everybody.
Before we throw this out to the audience, I'm a Michigander. I love Michigan. And I'm thrilled that you spend your summers here. And I'm thrilled that you bring your family here to do that. I'm guessing, I don't know, you could have a summer home anywhere in the world that you want. I don't know why you come to Michigan. Could be because, you know, the lower half shaped like an oven mitt.
He's good.
Maybe there's a deeper reason. Tell us about that. What does Michigan mean to you? Why are you here?
I grew up on the West Coast. I went to college on the East Coast. I spent some time in Italy. I really more or less dismissed everything east of Idaho and west of 10th Avenue as being insignificant. Met my wife, we came out here, she went to U of M, a lot of her friends. I must say, I hated Woody Hayes long before I met my wife. She had some friends, some of whom are at the table right now, who were in the parks department, I mean the national parks system, and we came out to visit them, and Susie used to come out here even before we were married and come out at Christmas or at a certain time and go to Eastport. And then she came out and brought me once, and we came out for 1 week, and then we went out for 2 weeks, then we went out for 3 weeks. And the next summer we said, all right, listen, we want to come out for the whole summer. The guy who rented us that first house is also at one of these tables. He said, I'm moving back into the house. Go screw yourselves. Find yourself something. So what we did is we started looking around for other rental properties, and we didn't find a single thing. But for the price of a small studio apartment in New York City, you can buy a house on the beach out here. So we decided we'd buy a house because we like spending so much time here. And as I said before, I'm going to be at 61 days this year. We spend as much as we can of our time here in the summer. We also come back for Thanksgiving. We also come back for Christmas. And what it really represents to me is a purity in in more than just an artistic and lifestyle way. It represents to me the American ideal of what can be really great, especially given the gastronomic rise and the wine rise and everything that goes along with all of that. But what it really represents is the pure American ideal. And quite frankly, it is the antidote to the lifestyle that we live in New York City. Not that I'm giving up the New York City part, but to be able to have something like Michigan to come to and live and enjoy and love is one of the true emotional cores of our family as a unit together. And it's just a remarkable and delicious and magnificent place. And it may have been somewhere else, but it wasn't. It's right here. So this is where we come, and this is what we love, and this is what we do. And I still go back to New York, and I still love New York, and I'm happy to do all my businesses there, because even if 5 million people hate you, there's 7 million left.
All right. Okay. So we're going to let the audience ask you some questions, but
I have one question before you finish. Hold on. What is the beating heart of Zingerman's genius? Can you put your hands on why it is so influential and so great? I mean, aside from you.
I don't really know how to answer that. We want, really, to tell you the truth, Ari and I met working in a restaurant, and I grew up in Detroit, and he grew up in Chicago, and growing up, you know, every neighborhood had a deli and where you could get you thought was the best corned beef sandwich in the world. We were stuck in Ann Arbor, and you couldn't get a real corned beef sandwich. You couldn't get real corned beef. You couldn't get a real rye bread. And so on the weekends, this was, you know, the 70s. We might imbibe a little and then want to, go get some corned beef sandwiches. And we'd drive to Detroit and we were working in this restaurant, and we were learning a couple things. One, we were starting to develop a real love for food, and we were learning a lot about it. And we were learning a lot about how we didn't want to run a business. And we had our thoughts about that. And we thought, let's just open a place and have a great corned beef sandwich, and we think people will come. I went off and with another person and opened a fish market. A wholesale and retail fish market, and then this spot across the street became available, and I went and got Ari and said, I found the place for us to open that deli we've been talking about, and we said we're going to gather the finest artisan-made products from around the world, and smash down in the middle of that, we're going to have this busy, bustling sandwich shop where we're going to have these sandwiches so big that it was going to take two hands to pick it up, and when you finally got it up to your mouth and bit into it, the dressing was going to roll down your forearms. And this was very clear in our minds before we ever opened the door. And we also, we wanted to have a place that was going to provide meaningful work and dignity and a sense of community for the people that worked there. And we made the decision, the strategic decision, that we were going to deliver that food to people with this very, very high level of service. This is 1982, and like if you go to the bookstore here today,
Horizon Bookstore,
the Horizon,
yes,
and you go three-story bookstore, and you go to the business section, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of books on customer service. One of them, Zingerman's Guide to Giving Great Service, is better than the rest. But back in 1982, there were no books on customer service. Customer service was a department you called when you had a complaint, okay, in a department store. And so we said we were going to wow people. We're going to service the hell out of people. We're going to make them understand that they're the most important part of their day and the only reason we got up and
turned on the sign and opened the door was on the chance that they would grace us with their presence. Because I don't know about New York, but in my town in Ann Arbor, there is nobody that gets up in the morning and says, if I don't get a $15 sandwich today, I'm going to kill myself. Okay? Nobody says, if I don't get a quarter of a pound of a $40 a pound cheese, life isn't worth living. We got to give them a reason for... So when they come in and spend that hard-earned money with us, I need them to walk out the door saying, I'm a smart person. That was a good decision I made. Those people made me feel really good. I like them. And so I think that really was we were going to bring really wonderful food. We were going to make it accessible to people. That's why the signs are comic, you know, they're whimsical, cartoon-like, was so people felt comfortable asking for a taste of a $150 bottle of aged balsamic vinegar. And you know, 29 years down the road, it looks like it paid off.
I must say, I think that the crucial lesson to be learned from either of our discussion this evening is that as smart as you may be, and as cool as you may be, there is always something to learn from someone sitting across the table from you.
Yes, there is. So just to make sure I get this out here, I really want to appreciate Mario for coming to our great state. This guy doesn't, you know, he talked to you how sacred this vacation is. He doesn't listen to his voicemails at all. He's not on email at all. But he interrupts it to come here and be with all of you guys tonight and help this great organization with a really wonderful mission. Okay, we got people out there with roaming microphones and people with questions.
Can we dim the house, the lights in front of me, just a bit? Or not? Oh, great. Perfect.
Mario, as a private citizen, thank you so much for what you do for our community and for this evening. If you were to sit down in your favorite restaurant with a blank menu, what would you order?
If it was a blank menu, I would have nothing to order.
No,
my favorite thing to eat is anything anyone else makes. So I'm a happy customer when I go to a restaurant. I hope they have a curated and well-thought-out opinion, but if I had to choose two of my favorite kind of restaurants to go to, one would be a taqueria, and the other would be a seafood place on the Amalfi Coast.
All right, we have another question right here.
Well, I think you just answered half of it. Where is your ancestral place in Italy, and which is your favorite region to eat in?
My family is from Chieti in Abruzzo and from Lucca in Toscana, and they're both magnificent. I spent the bulk of my learning experience time halfway between Bologna and Florence in the Apennine Mountains. When people ask me what my favorite place is, I say, depend on what day it is. I love everything about all 21 regions. That said, if I had two places to be and I had to choose, I would be somewhere off the Grand Canal in Venice or somewhere on the Amalfi Coast.
Thank you. We've got another one right here. Dan?
Thanks, Mario. Damn it, this is a question everybody has on their minds, but nobody will ask probably. On the Iron Chef on TV, which we all get hooked on, when they reveal the secret ingredient, is it really secret to you guys?
Uh-oh. I think you can ask Bridget, because Bridget and I battled, unfortunately, against each other at a certain point. And yeah, it's secret.
Thank you for listening to An Evening with Mario Batali. For more on the upcoming programs of the Traverse City National Writers Series, please visit their website at www.nationalwritersseries.org. This program was produced by Interlochen Public Radio. This is Aaron Stander.